Good morning.
This is session 211, The Cost of Discipleship, Dimensions of a Mature Mormon Faith, Robert Reese. I need to caution everyone to turn off noisemakers, cell phones. I think that's about the only caution. Bob will talk, and if there's time at the end, we'll entertain questions, and perhaps we'll provide some answers. Bob Reese has been doing Sunstone presentations for about as long as Sunstone has been going. He was the second editor of Dialogue. He has edited many things. He's fairly recently put together the Proving Contraries, the tribute book to Gene England. He has a book that's going to be coming out. He's editing a book that's going to be coming out this fall, published by Signature Books, called Why I Stay, The Challenge of Discipleship for Contemporary Mormons. He has written numerous studies of Mormon culture and religion, including Bearing Our Cross Gracefully, Sex and the Single Mormon. It was published in Dialogue. Many of his thesis have been published in Dialogue. This fall, Bob will be teaching Mormon studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. And those of us in the Bay Area are very pleased about this. He's kind of migrated up from Los Angeles up to the Santa Cruz area, now coming to the Bay Area. He tells me he has taught over 30 different kinds of courses, mostly literature courses, but has also taught ethics and religion courses, and will be teaching that kind of course at GTU this fall. He will let Bob take the rest of the time.
Thank you. Karen and I go back many, many years, and we studied French at the University of Laval in Quebec, and had one of the magical summers of at least my life. Can everyone hear? I suppose you couldn't tell if you hadn't heard me ask that question. At the end of this session, my guess is that some of you will probably feel like the farmer who, when an itinerant preacher went through the wilds of Montana handing out flyers for a big religious rally, did all kinds of things to get people there, and when he finally showed up to preach his sermon, there was one lone farmer sitting in the front, and he thought, well, I might as well do what I came here to do. So he gave this hour-long fire and brimstone sermon, and when he finished, he walked down and shook the man's hand and said, what'd you think of that? The farmer said, well, you know, it was pretty good, but the way I feel is if I went out and mowed my entire field of hay and dumped it in the field and only one cow come, I'd be damned if I'd give him the whole thing. You may feel that way when I finish. I've had a good deal of opportunity to think about what it means to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And what I say here today does not mean by any means that I feel that the dimensions of a mature faith are epitomized in my faith. But they are, for me, at least some of the dimensions of what I, at this point in my life, I feel a true disciple, a mature disciple of Christ, should have. Like that of most people, my faith has evolved over the years. It began with a simple, certain, and secure faith I had at age 10, when I first heard the restored gospel and was baptized by my father in the Mesa Temple. Over the years, it has slowly evolved into a much more complex, uncertain, and even dangerous faith. Complex is complex because it involves constant dialogue between my mind and heart. It's uncertain because it is constantly under revision in the light of new experiences and new challenges. And it is dangerous because at any point it may lead to unknown paths and uncharted territory. In some ways, I envy that earlier faith, which lasted essentially with some degree of change until I went on a mission, graduated from BYU, and entered graduate school. I look back on that time when nothing unsettled my faith and certainty was my essential state of mind. However, as much as I might occasionally long for such a cloistered faith and sequestered haven, I realized that one of the costs of true discipleship is a willingness to risk abandoning the secure and comfortable harbor of childhood and to set sail on that more turbulent sea of faith that Matthew Arnold describes in Dover Beach, a sea that sounds the eternal note of sadness for the turbid ebb and flow of human misery, its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar retreating down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world. Someone has described that living with a dynamic faith is like rebuilding a ship one plank at a time while in a storm at sea. In setting sail in such a ship on such a sea, I have found that I have become unable to escape the heartbreaking reality that characterizes much of the human condition, a reality that sometimes tests the limits of my faith. At the same time, I've gradually become more attentive to moments of grace in the botched world. It is for that botched world that Christ was nailed to the cross, and to which he invites us to take up our crosses and follow him. A mature faith involves bearing that cross. While I abjure Arnold's view of a world of lost faith that has, quote, neither joy nor love nor light nor certitude nor peace nor help for pain, I also recognize that for many of my fellow humans, such a word described at least some aspect of their physical and spiritual reality. I believe that those who achieve or who at least strive for a mature faith recognize that to whatever extent they are blessed to feel love, light, certitude, or peace, they are called to share those gifts with others, especially those who do not experience such things. In attempting to live a life of faith, I have concluded that the following are at least some of the dimensions of a mature faith. First, a commitment to honesty. This may be the most challenging demand of discipleship for no other reason than that there are so many kinds of dishonesty and so many temptations from self, others, and institutions to engage in it. It is also challenging because the cost of honesty can be very high. In a recent interview for Temple Recommend, when the question came up, are you honest in your dealings with others? I gave the answer I always have given, I try to be. And times when the interviewing authority said, well, yes or no, I respond, I can't give a yes or no, because there are so many complexities and so many nuances and so many conundra in which one has to make decisions of honesty that I can only say that I honestly try to be. The very first issue of Dialogue included Francis Menlove's remarkable essay, The Challenge of Honesty. 44 years after reading this essay, I find myself still challenged by it, still discomfited by its message. Speaking of personal honesty, Menlove writes, personal honesty involves courageously recognizing the discrepancy between what one ought to be and what one actually is, between what one is supposed to believe and what one actually believes. She adds, the individual who does not accept this challenge, who turns away and does not accept this discrepancy, which I would say includes all of us, consigns himself to a life of half-awareness, inauthenticity, and bad faith. He will not know what he thinks, but only what he ought to think. Menlove states that those charged with pastoral leadership have a particular obligation to set the example for honesty. The responsibility of the church is to help the individual in his quest for personal honesty. The church's leaders must demonstrate for its members the quest for honesty, exemplifying its manner and method in as pure a form as is humanly possible. When leaders are dishonest, as sometimes happens, members become confused and disillusioned. A friend recently confessed that she felt justified in lying during her Temple Recommend interview because the church had lied to her all of her life. That seemed to me more rationalization than anything. Nevertheless, I understood her logic if not her moral reasoning. What troubled some members of the church in California during the 2008 Proposition 8 campaign was the willingness of church leaders and members to produce and distribute literature that was proven, even while it was being distributed, to be misleading and in some instances even false. Television ads funded by contributions from church members played on people's fears and prejudices. Also disturbing was a revelation that church leaders were not open about the church's strategy or tactics in supporting the proposition. Correspondence leaked to the press revealed what seemed like a clandestine plan to campaign for the passage of the proposition without implicating the church. Again, to quote Menlove, quote, to use tricks of manipulation or salesmanship to distort arguments by taking them out of context or by skillful omission, no matter how good the intention or noble the aim, is to provide the participants with practice and deception and the observers with a blueprint for dishonesty.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Well, I think it will because you look down.
Oh, okay. Let me know. I'm happy to adjust this. One of the other manifestations or characteristics of mature discipleship is the willingness both to believe and to entertain doubts. We live in a skeptical world, one in which belief is under constant siege. There are reasons for this, of course, many resulting from people of faith doing and saying things in the name of faith that alienate even the most open-minded seeker of truth. When faith is used as a weapon, or when it leads to violence, exclusion, indifference, or pride, reasonable people can be excused for questioning its value and its virtue. Thus, many things are claimed in the name of faith that cannot be justified by a thoughtful heart or the honest ponderings of the Spirit. In other words, more than agnostics or atheists, people of faith have given faith a bad name. Because of this, or in spite of it, it takes a certain amount of courage to act on faith. A dynamic faith is not one that is settled and sure, but rather one that is open to challenge and change. A faith without some tension is not likely to grow. While we tend to think of faith as something we either have or don't have, mature disciples recognize that faith and doubt are not necessarily opposites, but two parts of an essential human process, one that strives to make sense of a world that is both good and evil, simple and complex, real and imagined, visible and invisible. In other words, true faith is not content just with answers, but also asks questions, recognizing that there are questions that open the heart and questions that close it. As a member of the Santa Cruz High Council in 2007, I gave a talk on doubt and faith in the ward I was assigned to that month. Among other things, I said that in spite of the seeming prohibition against it within Mormon culture, I had found it impossible at times to escape doubt, as I suspected most of my listeners had. I said that honest doubt was not a sign of weakness or lack of faith, but, as the 20th century theologian Paul Tillich argued, it is essentially a manifestation of faith because it involves seeking a resolution to a matter of ultimate concern. Not long after I spoke, the state president called me into his office, as it turned out, to correct me. We had a discussion about my remarks. When I told him that my faith included doubts, he responded, "We can have questions, but not doubts." I'm afraid that sentiment is shared by many Latter-day Saints. But doubt, at least for some, seems not only inescapable, but a necessary prelude to a more mature faith. A good example of this is Thomas the Apostle, who doubted the reports of the other people that they had seen the risen Lord, earning him the sobriquet Doubting Thomas, as a label that has persisted through the ages for someone whose faith requires empirical evidence. But consider Thomas's case. Not long before this episode, the other disciples had disbelieved the reports of the women hastening to bring them news from the empty tomb. Nevertheless, seeing the risen Lord standing before them, they believed. Since no one had ever returned from the grave before, it would have been unusual for Thomas not to doubt, the veracity of his fellow disciples. For those of us for whom the rising of Christ from the dead is as axiomatic as the rising of the morning sun, it is perhaps too difficult to appreciate Thomas's skepticism, but it was a very natural response to what must have seemed an impossibility. As Emily Dickinson said, Thomas's faith in anatomy was greater than his faith in faith. Although he doubted the testimony of others, when he saw the risen Lord, Thomas, with his own eyes, Thomas exclaimed, "My Lord and my God," earning him the less well-known name of Thomas the Believer. We need to remember that Christ blessed both kinds of faith. Blessed are those who believe without seeing, and blessed are those who need evidence to see. As to Thomas's faith, we tend to forget that it was he who, when Christ was on the road to Calvary, said to the others, "Let us also go that we may die with him." In this instance, his faith was greater than that of Peter's. Each Fast Sunday, most state conferences and some general conferences, I hear statements the validity of which I doubt or am uncertain. In church publications and media outlets, as well as in the blogosphere, some claims of divine intervention, miraculous happenings, or revelation strike me as questionable or at least worthy of skepticism. For example, for the past 40 years, I've been intimately involved in issues relating to homosexuality within my faith community. At first, I accepted conventional and even official pronouncement that homosexuality was a chosen and a changeable condition. But the more I read the writings of biologists and psychologists, the more homosexuals I knew personally, and the more I studied the scriptures, the more I came to doubt the truth of these assertions. That doubt led me to write and speak about the issue and to challenge thinking that I found unsupported either by science or by scripture or ultimately by the deepest feelings of my heart. Latter-day Saints forget that at times it has been necessary to shake the foundations of established faith in order to find greater faith, as was the case when Joseph Smith entered the dark wood of convention and returned to declare to the world the scandalous news that the heavens are not closed, but simply awaiting our imaginative engagement. It is remarkable that a religion that had such a radical beginning and such a liberal unfolding should have become one of the most conservative religious communities in the United States. It reminds me of Robert Frost's line, "I never dared be radical when young, for fear it would make me conservative when old." While there is an understandable impulse in most of us towards certainty and closure, and away from ambivalence and openness, it is important to remind ourselves that few things in science or religion are absolutely settled. Each generation is charged with challenging the axioms of the past and giving new expressions to whatever truths we have come to accept. This isn't to say that there are no eternal truths or principles, only that history has shown that we close our minds and hearts to the possibilities of new understanding, even of grounded truths, at our peril. Joseph Smith began the Restoration because he had doubts about some of the dogmatic pronouncements he heard at other churches and camp meetings in and around Palmyra. At times, we can observe a similar dogmatism in our own faith. Joseph's experience in the Sacred Grove should convince us that the heavens are not closed to prophets or to any honest seeker of truth. As Latter-day Saints, we accept this in theory, but not often enough in practice. Another characteristic of mature faith is a rejection of blind obedience. Obedience, including obedience to authority, is one of the most complex matters for a mature believer. She recognizes that obedience can be seen as an important and at times even a necessary virtue in general, those in authority both deserve and need. Otherwise, many important matters would never be accomplished. But obedience can also be a vice. I heard a state president say something like the following in state conference: "I know we aren't supposed to believe in blind obedience, but sometimes I wish we did." Knowing him as I do, I knew that he was at more than at least half serious. The name itself, Blind Obedience, should give us some clue as to its virtue. Blindness was considered a divine curse in the ancient world, and we should consider blind obedience so in ours. Blind obedience means being obedient in spite of what we see or understand as undeserving of our allegiance or obedience. As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. Blindness leads not to light, but to darkness. As Giuliana Palasama observes, in Western culture, sight has historically been regarded as the noblest of the senses, and thinking itself thought of in terms of seeing. Since the Greeks, philosophical writing of all times have abounded with ocular metaphors to the point that knowledge has become analogous with clear vision, and light is regarded as a metaphor for truth. As the hymn Amazing Grace expresses, I once was blind, but now I see. A blind faith does not lead to seeing. If a blind faith does not lead to blind, if a blind faith does not lead to seeing, then it must remain indeed blind. Another characteristic of mature faith is a commitment to both faith and reason. Faith and reason have always had an uneasy coexistence. Often they are seen as antagonists, each disdaining or attacking the other. Yet both are essential to a mature faith. Faith or reason alone cannot possibly see as far or as deeply as they can together. And yet for many, reason seems a threat to faith. It can be, of course, but no more than faith is a potential threat to reason. Faith alone seems ascendant in the contemporary church as a thinking and reasoning were somehow less adequate, perhaps even illegitimate paths to truth. I often have said to people, I distrust two types of Mormons, those who never think and those who only think. Discipleship requires both freedom and of belief and freedom of mind, and yet the latter is more under attack in Mormon culture than is the former. In an address to BYU students in 1969 called An Eternal Quest, Freedom of the Mind, President Hubie Brown addressed this issue. One of the most important things in the world is freedom of mind. From this, all other freedoms spring. From this, all other freedoms spring. Such freedom is necessarily dangerous, for one cannot think right without running the risk of thinking wrong. But generally, more thinking is required. And we call upon you students at BYU and faculty at BYU and all of us outside of BYU to exercise your God-given right to think through on every proposition that is submitted to you and be unafraid to express your opinions with proper respect for those to whom you talk and proper acknowledgement of your own shortcomings. Be unafraid to express your thoughts and insist upon your right to examine every proposition. Where is President Brown when we need him so badly? President Brown then spoke words that, coming from the mouth of a member of the First Presidency, I still find almost unbelievable 41 years later. This is what he said. We are not so much concerned with whether your thoughts are orthodox or heterodox as we are that you shall have thoughts. By using the plural pronoun, he intended that we consider his message as coming from the First Presidency, not from him alone. In a climate in which there is such a pull for our orthodoxy, in which any expression of heterodoxy, real or imagined, is seen as alien and enemy, it is difficult to imagine a church leader today expressing such a sentiment. And yet how grateful we should be that President Brown did so. Again, it is important to remind ourselves that it was exactly his heterodoxy that led Joseph Smith and other restoration shakers of the foundation to look for truth beyond established truth and wisdom beyond conventional thinking. It is important to remember that President Brown's remarks were given during a time when Apostle Ezra Taft Benson was heavily involved in promulgating ideas about a communist takeover of American government and society and promoting the agenda of the John Birch Society. In fact, Elder Benson's anti-communist book, An Enemy Hath Done This, was published the same year that President Brown gave his address. President Brown's address reminds us that the Lord has invited us to reason together with him, suggesting not only that he values reason, but that he invites dialogue based on reason. Another characteristic of mature faith is an openness to imagination. I don't believe that one can truly have a mature faith that isn't to some degree graced with imagination. The mature believer recognizes that the gods themselves imagined everything before they brought it into being. She also recognizes that at times her capacity for imagination, for wonder, for invention, may be greater than that of seers and prophets. She doesn't flinch from the presence of such realization, but neither does she flee from it. She does what she can, when she can, with what truth has been revealed to her heart and mind. We don't often speak of imagination in Christ in the same breath, but I read the Gospels as the product of a great and fecund imagination. It isn't just the inventive language, the subtle irony and humor, and the fresh narratives that flowed from his fertile mind and heart that make Jesus of Nazareth such a great imaginer, but especially his capacity to imagine each one of us caught in the snares of sin, lost in the tangled wood of temptation, each uniquely in need of love, mercy, and grace. Beyond this was his godlike capacity to imagine each one of us glorified beings, each of our futures a reflection of his present. Only such an imagination, I am convinced, could have emboldened him to descend into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday and to ascend to Calvary the following Friday. If we share some of Christ's imaginative gifts, as I believe we all have the capacity to do when we take upon his name, then we can use such gifts to expand his work in the world. We can imagine not only that, but how we can be better disciples than we are, and the church a better institution than it is. The church, I imagine, like Joseph Smith's view of God, can be, quote, more liberal in its views and more boundless in its mercies than we are ready to believe. The future of the church depends as much on our imaginations as it does on our faith. Until we recognize that our imaginations are one of the important gifts of the Spirit and essential to the unfolding of Christ's kingdom, we will be incapable of recognizing the full capacity of our discipleship in realizing the promise that, quote, God will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God. If in the church we could imagine change beyond policy and practice, beyond culture, perhaps even beyond doctrine itself, we may become agents of change and thereby help transform the church, perhaps liberate it from some of its less enlightened traditions and even glorify it in new ways. As Ihab Hassan says, quote, liberations come from some strange region where the imagination meets change. We need to reimagine change itself, else we labor to confirm all of our errors. Another characteristic of a mature faith is the courage to reject, to resist coercion, and to challenge consensus. To have a mature faith is to have the courage at times not to believe what others claim as incontrovertible truth. There are Latter-day Saints, including some leaders, who will emotionally excommunicate someone they feel has strayed even a smidgen from orthodoxy. But under certain circumstances, orthodoxy can become a Procrustean bed that stifles and confines the spirit. In her essay, The Tyranny of Petty Coercion, Marilyn Robinson speaks of prevenient courage, quote, the intellectual and moral courage necessary to challenge the status quo. She says there is a paucity of such forms of courage because they threaten to violate loyalty and group identity. She adds, they are intrinsically outside the range of consensus. Consensus, of course, is helpful and even necessary in some instances and contexts. Without some degree of consensus, little would be done in the world. However, a total insistent consensus can stop thought and progress, and it can cover a multitude of sins. As Robinson says, quote, it should never be forgotten how much repression and violence consensus can support, how many crimes it has justified. An example within Mormon culture is the consensus of silence about what really happened at Mountain Meadows that lasted for more than a century, much, I am convinced, to the detriment and disadvantage of the church. Consensus can create unity, which can lead to much good. But when consensus comes in conflict with conscience, it can lead, quote, to the effective enforcement of consensus in those many instances where neither reason nor data endorse it, where there are no legal constraints supporting it, and where there are penalties for challenging it, that persons of even moderate brio would consider deterrents. A modern example was the priesthood ban for blacks. Long after the scriptural and cultural scaffolding supporting this practice had been dismantled, long after the wider culture had found it untenable, it was kept in place in the church largely because of consensus. Consensus that there had been an original revealed doctrine reinforced by subsequent spiritual or revelatory confirmations to many prophets. Consensus about what turned out to be the misreading of Scripture, and consensus that passive acceptance of this teaching was a mark of loyalty. Before the 1976 change in church policy, a small but growing number of saints had broken emotionally and even spiritually with the church over this issue. Essentially, they could no longer hold in their hearts and minds the belief that certain of their fellow humans could be treated as if they were inferior members of Christ's kingdom, and be denied the blessings available to other members, all because of their presumed unrighteousness in the preexistence and cursed skin color. Through study and earnest prayer, some came to question the old cultural constructs that had produced such a policy, and the consensus that protected it and perpetuated it for well over a century. Some saints left the church over this issue, but many did not, in spite of the opprobrium of their fellow members for holding what those members considered heretical ideas and a refusal to follow the prophets. When, in the light of what I believe was incontrovertible evidence that this teaching came not by revelation, but by cultural evolution, the policy was eventually changed and consensus began to fray. Perhaps we will never know the full story of how that change came about, but I think history will show that Lester Bush's landmark article, Mormonism's Negro Doctrine and Historical Overview, published in Dialogue in 1973, was one of the important factors. For the first time, Bush demonstrated that the elaborate rationalizations that supported that doctrine for over 100 years were without foundation. What many had accepted as incontrovertible truth was undermined by a careful, dispassionate laying out of the historical, scriptural, and doctrinal record. The surprising thing is that no one had undertaken the task before. That change in policy, I believe, is an example of how horizontal insight, if not revelation, from a lay member can influence vertical revelation. According to Gregory Prince, in his biography of David O. McKay, Bush's article had played a pivotal role in the process by which Spencer W. Kimball ultimately received the revelation that one of his predecessors, David O. McKay, had sought without success for many years. Only last year, he learned from a grandson that President Kimball had underlined and annotated virtually Bush's entire article in his own copy of Dialogue. We now know that there was considerable resistance to change. We now know that there was considerable resistance to change in this policy among the top leadership. Thus, Bush had the courage to challenge the general consensus of the church, and President Kimball had the courage to challenge consensus at the highest levels of church governance. For the most part, scholars and others who had challenged consensus over the years before President Kimball's announced change did not boast of their superior insight or seek to embarrass the church over what they saw as its misguided teaching, but rather rejoiced that the change had come and that they could embrace their black brothers and sisters as equal in the kingdom of God. This is an example of what Francis Menlove states: the members of the church are responsible for the church. In other words, the stewardship of the church rests on the general membership as well as on the general authorities. Robinson acknowledges, quote, that consensus enforcement and the endless small concessions made to endless small coercions are no doubt universal in human civilization, but she argues they cannot be without cost precisely because they disable courage. She concludes, no one can truly submit to unreasonable coercion by suppressing one's thinking, one's identity, or one's metaphysics without failing a little in one's own estimation. A successful autocracy rests on the universal failure of individual courage. Another characteristic from a dear disciple is a refusal to cover the past or ignore the present. A mature disciple does not participate in what might be called ecclesiastical amnesia over the consequences of such a teaching as denial of priesthood ordination to blacks. He finds himself unable to forget the injustice and heartbreak caused by such a policy or to ignore its residue in the contemporary church where many continue to see blacks as less than worthy of full fellowship. He does not believe that a declaration of change in policy or doctrine without some acknowledgement of the error or complicity that sustained it, even if that change comes by revelation, will suddenly erase all that came before it, especially if there is no institutional recognition of the false traditions and deep-rooted prejudice that led to them, nor the coercion of consensus that perpetuated them for so long. A mature disciple knows it is important to retain institutional memory of that past. Otherwise, racist statements by Brigham Young, John Taylor, Mark E. Peterson, and others will be repressed or be treated as if they took place on another planet. How many people of African descent would now be members of the church had the church followed the more liberal position on race held by Joseph Smith? How much suffering and anguish of soul might have been spared if we had sought a more enlightened teaching a century earlier? I think of the black brother that Elder Marion D. Hanks told me about, whom he baptized as a young missionary who came to Salt Lake, who said to him, I would strip every inch of black skin off my body if I could hold the priesthood. Or the black sister who, while in the temple recently in the Salt Lake Valley, overheard another sister saying, I didn't know they allowed niggers in the temple. There are other beliefs, policies, and practices within Mormonism that are held in place by our refusal to learn from the past or even to acknowledge it in some instances, just as there are others that spring from present circumstances that are defended as eternal truths that in reality are culturally relative. Mature disciples recognize that the future of the church depends on honestly coming to terms with the past and with the present. Another characteristic of a mature disciple is a willingness to embrace paradox. During the first years of my adult life, I was uncomfortable with paradox, feeling that somehow I had to resolve every spiritual contradiction, untangle every religious conundrum, and solve every theological problem. I had been led to believe that irresolution, ambiguity, and uncertainty were marks of a weak faith. I sometimes run into people who remind me how intolerable I was. At some point, I came to understand that a mature believer not only cannot escape such states of mind and spirit, ultimately, they must be willing to embrace them. For me, a turning point came during my first years in teaching at UCLA, when in a conversation with LDS historian Leonard Arrington, he remarked that he had a shelf in his mind labeled to be answered later, where he put unresolved and seemingly unresolvable questions. Somehow the urgency to find and to give an answer to every question diminished for me. In his essay, Paradox and Discipleship, Terrell Gibbons says, paradox is the sign of a healthy universe. Paradox is a sign of richness and plenitude. It is Adam and Eve reaching for both godly aspiration and childlike submission. It is priesthood that is power with no compulsion. It is an infinitely powerful God who is sovereign of the universe and yet is vulnerable to pain as a widow with a wayward son. To ignore paradox or to flee from it is to choose a lesser spiritual life. Again, to quote Gibbons, those not intellectually adventurous enough to embrace the paradox find easy refuge falling to one side or the other of the tightrope, capitulating in a blind faith to no faith, and posturing as the enlightened apostate who grew out of his innocence, and that he is neither enlightened nor innocent. A mature disciple continues to wrestle with the paradoxes inherent in the universe in human nature and even perhaps especially in his own nature. He accepts Joseph Smith's dictum, by proving contraries, truth is made manifest. I'm running out of time with my long list of characteristics of a disciple. One is the recognition that the most important dimension of a mature faith is love. As one looks around on the world, it would seem as if faith and love were as alien as oil and water. And yet faith without love is as meaningless as faith without works or without grace. That much of what is expressed daily in the name of faith, whether Christian, Jewish, Islamic, Hindi, or otherwise, is without love makes the point profoundly. Fundamentalist faith is often devoid of love, is often expressed in defense of tradition, ecclesiastical authority, and dogma over the physical and spiritual needs of individuals. William Sloane Coffin puts it perfectly. There are those who prefer certainty to truth, those in the church who put the purity of dogma above the integrity of love. And what a distortion of the gospel it is to have limited sympathies and unlimited certainties when the very reverse, that is to have limited certainties and unlimited sympathies, is not only more tolerant, but far more Christian. Christ's life was a seamless joining of faith and love. Every act of faith was an act of love, and every act of love was an act of faith. They were as inseparable as the dancer and the dance. I'll go on to quickly talk about B.H. Roberts' two kinds of disciples. A century ago, Robert, Mormon intellectual and general authority, B.H. Roberts, noted the distinction made by the American philosopher John Fiske between two kinds of disciples. Fiske wrote, "There are first disciples, pure and simple, people who fall under the spell of a person or a doctrine and whose whole intellectual life thenceforth consists in their partisanship. They expound and defend and ward off foes and live and die faithful to the one formula." Fiske adds that such disciples may be indispensable at first in helping a new teaching get a popular hearing, but in the long run they rather hinder than help the wholesome growth of the very ideas they defend, for great ideas live by growing, and a doctrine that is merely to be preached over and over in the same terms cannot possibly be the whole truth. He adds, disciples of the first sort often become, as Schopenhauer said, mere magnifying mirrors wherein one sees enlarged all the defects of doctrine. There is a comfort and security in a gospel that is merely, that as, to quote him, to quote Fiske, merely to be preached over and over in the same terms. Most believers, including most Latter-day Saints, I believe, gravitate to such safety and security. Nowhere is this more evident in my mind than the correlated gospel doctrine manuals and lessons. Four-year cycle after four-year cycle, we go through the same lessons, given the same interpretation, the same proof to scriptures, giving the same answers to the same questions, all to confirm that the ideas that we all agreed on are not only true, but settled and final. I taught a lesson recently in my ward, and I asked, what does the Jewish mother say when her son comes home? What question does she ask when her son comes home from Hebrew school? And everybody said, what did you learn? She asked him, what did you learn? I said, no. She asked, did you ask good questions? So I began my gospel doctrine lessons when I'm asked to teach, which isn't very frequent these days. What questions can we answer that will give us new insight to this lesson? I must say that sometimes people are uncomfortable even with that question. Fiske makes a distinction between what he calls disciples whose whole intellectual life consists of their partisanship and what he calls disciples of a second sort, those who have been attracted to a new doctrine by the fact that it gave expression in a novel way to some large and deep interest which had already grown up in themselves. Fiske and then Robert's commentary on this goes on to talk about how every religion needs disciples of the second sort, those who are willing to challenge the axioms, those who are willing to question, those who are willing to open their hearts and minds to greater expansion of those truths. And he talks about the second disciple, or those, to using Christ's metaphor, of the sower who will bring forth fruits 30, 60, 100 fold when they return to their master, their own, with usury. B.H. Roberts talks about the restoration, and he says, Mormonism affords opportunity for disciples of the second sort. Nay, its crying need is for such disciples. He calls for thoughtful disciples who will not be content with merely repeating some of its truths, but will develop its truths and enlarge it by that development. Roberts himself was such a disciple, as evidenced by his willingness to challenge orthodoxy, but also by using the power of his intellect and spirit to expand the boundaries of Mormon thought and belief. The reason Robert called for more mature discipleship was what he saw it as essential for the full flowering of the Restoration. And then he said something quite remarkable. Not half, not 1/100th part, not 1,000th part. Think of that. Not 1,000th part of that which Joseph Smith revealed to the church has yet been unfolded either to the church or to the world. Not 1,000th part has yet been unfolded either to the church or to the world. And then he says that the work of the expounder has scarcely begun. And the prophet planted the teaching of the germ truths of the great dispensation. The watering and weeding is going on. God is giving the increase and will give it more abundantly in the future as more intelligent discipleship shall obtain. Well, I end by talking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer's idea of the difference between cheap faith and costly faith, or what he called cheap grace and costly grace. Bonhoeffer tried to make this distinction between a Christianity of abstract doctrine and neatly formulated principles and non-threatening systems. Bonhoeffer felt that the Christian church in Germany had fallen into a comfortable religiosity, one that led to a lazy Christianity and an ultimate and disastrous accommodation with the Third Reich. For Bonhoeffer, the cost of such an accommodation was abandoning Jesus' call for fierce obedience to the Sermon on the Mount and true Christian discipleship. His challenge to his Christian followers was to courageously and honestly face the challenge of the life Christ calls us to. For Bonhoeffer, chief grace led to soft Christianity, the comfortable kind of spirituality that requires no real courage or sacrifice. As a Christian, he committed himself to, quote, the stark, unbending command of Christ in the Sermon on the Mount. In his essay, The Cost of Discipleship, Bonhoeffer wrote, "In the last resort, what we want is not what would this or that man or this or that church have of us, but what would Jesus Christ himself want of us?" That is a challenging question to ask, especially at a time when seeking an answer has been reduced to a trite formula, WWJD. What would Jesus do? A better expression is found in 3 Nephi. "Therefore, what manner of men or women ought ye to be? Verily I say unto you, even as I am." As Bonhoeffer says, the real trouble is that the pure word of Jesus has been overlaid with so much human ballast, and I say this is true in Christianity as well as in Mormonism. Burdensome rules and regulations, false hopes and consolations, that it has become extremely difficult to make a genuine decision for Christ. A mature disciple faces that extreme difficulty with humility, courage, and especially love, recognizing, as Bonhoeffer did, that ultimately it may cost him everything, including his life, as it did Bonhoeffer and Joseph Smith. Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes for questions. Are there any of you? If you'd like to, please come up and use the mic.
Thank you for really a remarkable paper. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You hit on a really interesting, perplexing
Excuse me, can you put that in the
air? Is it off?
It's close.
Pretty close? Yeah. Okay. You hit on a really interesting dilemma for those who would try to guide a church community. On the one hand, they need to sort of have a handle on things that they don't get too wild. And on the other hand, the importance of this individual spirituality and novelty and progression. The ancient Christian church, as you know, the Gnostics had a lot of this exciting novelty, but became a little wild. And bishops, understandably, felt like they had to get a handle on it and threw the baby out with the bathwater. In our own time, there's kind of a similar thing. You know, it's very Gnostic-like in the beginning of the church, excitement and ideas, and then the need to sort of consolidate it and what's reliable. And so the dilemma is, how do you balance this wonderful individual spiritual revelation versus what's reliable? Should we just have the Sermon on the Mount as the reliable side? There's the paradox that you've got.
It's a paradox, and it seems to me the terrifically challenging problem of being a general authority. I have great sympathy or an empathy for people who have to govern a worldwide church with such a wide spectrum, a church that includes not only people like me, but people like Glenn Beck. I think it's very difficult, but I think the challenge should not make us flee from the reality of trying to do that. We, you know, if someone observed that individuals leave the church from the left, groups leave it from the right, however they leave it, to me, it's a tragedy. And unfortunately, I think we are in a climate where there seems to be much more toleration of people. In other words, anyone want to test this, just get up in testimony meeting and say anything slightly liberal or progressive and balance that against all of the things that are said that nobody blinks at that are just as much on the other side. The fact that we have to try and do that, it seems to me, requires of all of us, including people who are liberal, progressive, or wherever you are, to have great charity and love. I mean, I feel that the failure, essentially, of church polity often is a failure of love. A failure to love those people who are on the fringes or those people who have questions instead of embracing them. And I think it's a hard thing to embrace people like me or people who raise questions. But the option is to have those people leave. And when those people leave, the church is weakened and we're all the poorer for it. So it's a challenge, but it's not one that I think we should flee from. There, by the way, there were 10 other characteristics of a mature disciple that I'm still not the end of all of my characteristics. I may never be there. Yes, brother.
I'm not sure if this is one of your. Can everybody hear me? I'm not sure if this is one of your characteristics or not. I can't remember all of them. But when you're talking about Bonhoeffer and his, I guess, courage to stand up to the Nazis.
Especially courage.
Especially courage. Also, sort of, there's another one you mentioned, questioning or ability to question truth claims. I really latched onto that because I'm pretty familiar with Bonhoeffer's story. And I was also thinking of Helmut Krubiner, and a lot of people here probably know about him, but he was a Mormon 14-year-old boy in Nazi Germany. He was the only member of one of the only members of his ward who stood up to Hitler. And everybody else in his ward, well, nobody really supported him.
Two of his colleagues.
A couple of his friends, same age. But like his bishop excommunicated him. And
who would imagine courage and faith in a 14-year-old boy? I seem to remember early 19th century, somebody went into the woods and asked a question. Yes, go ahead.
I haven't asked a question yet, but I'm about to. Do you think it's possible, given that we have a hierarchical organization in our church, and we often gravitate, therefore, toward hierarchical governmental organizations to supporting those, do you think it's possible that, as an organization, we could ever come to that kind of individual, that kind of questioning that is so often found in the individual?
I think a lot of it. It's interesting what President Brown said, to be unafraid to question with proper respect for those to whom you question. Very often our questioning is without respect, without love. Bonhoeffer's was, if anything, nothing if not inspired by his love. His willingness, and almost the last order that Hitler gave was hang Bonhoeffer. Bonhoeffer was a thorn in Hitler's side. Even when the Third Reich was collapsing, And there was Bonhoeffer out in a prison a couple of days before Easter Sunday. He was hanged. But he knew that that might be the cost of his courageous discipleship of Christ. Again, I don't look for easy answers. I think I think there are many people in the leadership of the church, I would say most, who have the impulse toward trying to govern this unruly body of saints with charity, with love, with humility. I think it's a very difficult problem, but I think in some ways, as a church, we fail. And I think we fail partly because we don't keep in mind what Bonhoeffer says. I think it takes a lot of courage and humility to challenge orthodoxy. It takes a lot of courage and faith to live orthodoxy too.
Really love the talk. Define the word love for me, and maybe the way I should put it. This word love bothers me because it can mean so many things to so many people. What are the evidences of love?
I prefer, Scott Peck gave to me the best definition of love that I know. Love is a willingness to extend yourself on behalf of your own or someone else's spiritual growth. Love is a willingness to extend yourself on behalf of your own or someone else's spiritual growth.
Given the obvious cost and struggle of this kind of mature discipleship that you're talking about, how do you respond to someone who questions the value of that struggle and pain within a given context, such as the LDS context, rather than separating yourself from the context that makes it so painful?
Yeah, it's a great question. I like to think of faith and spirituality as on a continuum. And there are people who need the security of where they are, for whom questioning is too emotionally disturbing. I respect that. As we hopefully evolve spiritually, we might get to the point where we not only understand the value of questioning, but we understand the value of loving those who don't question. There isn't a single model. In an essay I published in Dialogue Forgiving the Church and Loving the Saints. In that essay, I tried to say that we have to forgive the church for what its failures. Just we have to love the saints for what we sometimes expect of them, just because of no other reason we expect God to love us with all of our infirmities and all of our weaknesses. This is why ultimately the ultimate characteristic of a mature disciple is love. It is a willingness to suffer the disapproval of fellow members. It's a willingness to suffer unjust decisions by church leaders. It's a willingness to extend ourselves on behalf of others' spiritual growth, even if it means that other people see us as less than what we are. Yes?
I was just wondering, through your experience, if what your sense is for how much of this mature discipleship is present among the uppermost leadership of the church, like the people who would be sitting on the stand at General Conference, and what you think the effect would be if that percentage were higher, how you think that would trickle down.
Joseph Smith changed the New Testament scripture, judge not, except you judge with a righteous judgment. I want to make it very clear, I do not sit in judgment of those who sit in judgment over me. I think that a true evaluation of anybody who studies history would be that the general authorities, there's a wide spectrum of leaders. I think they are all good and earnest men, unfortunately still all men, who strive to do what God calls them to do. We know from reading history that some of them have prejudices and biases and blind spots. I know some of them personally and find them to be among the best people that I know. Some of them who feel the burden of their calling enormously, One spoke at our state conference a year and a half ago, who the Sunday just before Proposition 8, and said, I know there's a lot of division in the Santa Cruz stake over Proposition 8. I couldn't sleep all night. I got up at 2 o'clock and tried to write down my thoughts as to what I would say, but you could just see he was terribly conflicted internally about trying to look at a congregation that was, I was going to say divided, but it was talking more like 99%. And a couple of us here on the other side. But I think the thing is that he still understood that tension. He still understood that his stewardship included people like me and some of my friends who were not thrilled with Proposition 8. So I would not want to be a general authority. I would not want to go to Africa and have somebody bring me a blind baby and say, give this baby its sight. I would not want to try and accommodate all of the very complex and growing problems of trying to administer a growingly diverse church. But I also would love to see more people like Duff Hanks and Hubie Brown, who were unabashedly and unapologetically liberal, and who championed those people in the church who were liberal and progressive and all. So there is an imbalance, I think, in the church. I think the church is far, Utah is the most conservative state in the nation. I think that says something. It isn't all Gentiles who make up that conservatism. As you know, in the 19th century, when Utah finally had statehood, the general authority said, everybody over here belongs to one party, everybody here belongs to another party. I think we ought to start again. I think Gene England once said, we need a fresh start. I just want a little bit of warning, so I'm on which side to sit on. But I think there is a terrific imbalance, and I think it affects, it cannot but help affect the church. And it affects the church in the sense that, in my state, California, it's the reputation of the church has suffered significantly over Proposition 8. I think unnecessarily so. I think it all could have been handled in a much better way than it was. So a friend of mine said, for every complex problem, there's a simple answer that won't work. Beware of simple solutions. But good heavens, we have to, this group of people, this small group of people here come here every year. Nobody out there even pays attention to us. This small group of people, I think, is part of the leaven in Christ's loaf. And I honor your coming here. I honor your willingness to engage in dialogue. I honor your continuing to see this as part of your Latter-day Saint heritage and your Latter-day Saint faith. I can make no promise except that for some people, I remember writing a letter to Elder Hanks, and I said to him, it's because of you that many of us are in the church. Your willingness, and he suffered a lot of opprobrium because of his willingness to be speak out, including in councils. And I said, you have held and are holding many people in the church. And he wrote back and said, that's the nicest letter I've ever received. And I think it's important for us to express to people who are bold enough and courageous enough to stand against the tide, to let them know that their faith emboldens our faith, that their love sets an example for our love. And I think, ultimately, the only definition, somebody asked, what's the definition of? The only definition is the scripture one, God is love. Thank you again.